And
well,
you
wonder, there used to be a bunch of us that hung out in the Rathskeller, that's Norman Anderson.
Oh, yes.
And Norm Zajac.
Yeah, no, I was not in that group.
You're not in that group?
No, I wasn't. No. But
I remember, I thought we met when I was an undergraduate. I was class of 51.
Yes, I think we did. And I did some work for the Union News Bureau, did a fair amount of writing for them, and also did a fair amount of writing for the Athenian in publicizing the magazine.
Oh, right. Now it's all coming back. Yeah. And Felicity, the woman who's the head of the union, I'm trying to remember her name.
Well, there was Ann Minahan.
Ann Minahan, okay.
And Betty Casper.
Those were all, now the names are coming back.
Yeah, right. It's amazing how they're all stored back there. Well, I appreciate your willingness to be interviewed. And let me give you a bit of background. After I graduated, the Korean War began, and I realized I would soon be drafted. So I put everything up in the attic, all my school papers. And then after my dad died, my mother sold the house, said, you got to get rid of this stuff. So I brought it to Madison. I was up here by then with the faculty, put it in the attic here in Madison. And my wife recently said, we've got to start paring things down. And in going through it all, I found that I had a big, thick file on the Athenian. I had all the letters I had written home that my mother had saved. And so I began looking into the Athenian to find out what the story was. The archives had some material, and what I had complimented it. But there were some questions that were unresolved in my mind. And I did get in contact with Jim Haight, did a couple of interviews with him. He was very helpful.
Where's Jim living now?
He's living out in Pasadena.
Oh, okay.
And seems to be quite active and very alert. He's probably 85 or 86, I think.
Yeah, I just turned 84.
You did. Well, you beat me. I'm still 83.
A young guy,
yeah. So anyway, I began scouting around. Jim gave me some useful information and then said, gee, what about Carl Meyer? So I contacted your organization, and lo and behold, here we are. So
great.
I thought I would not ask you about your career. I thought I could refer people to the Wikipedia site, which gives a quite complete story, and I'm sure you don't necessarily want to keep repeating about your great accomplishments time after time. So
just be sure to add, my wife and I have just published a new book called Pax Ethnica, Ethnic Peace, Where and How Diversity Succeeds.
Oh, yes. It's on the Wikipedia list of
references. On the Wikipedia. Yeah. I just want to make sure it's there.
Yeah.
It just came out 2 months ago.
Good. What countries were you looking at?
Well, we picked five. First was Flensburg, Germany, which had been at the heart of the Schleswig-Holstein dispute that went on for a century and caused two wars between the Danes and the Germans,
mm-hmm.
and the Danes traded land for peace, and that's what we describe in that chapter. The next chapter is on the Republic of Tatarstan in the Russian Federation,
oh, yeah.
Which is roughly half and half Islamic Tatars and Orthodox Christians. And they have chosen a form of autonomy rather than independence,
mm-hmm.
Unlike the Chechens.
Mm-hmm.
But then the city of Marseille, which has the biggest Muslim population in Europe, 240,000 out of 800,000, and Marseille nevertheless was quiet in 2005 when there were riots going on everywhere in France.
Yeah.
Then the state of Kerala in India, which has the highest literacy, life expectancy, and everything else, and has every imaginable religion, and they all get along, and that's a very interesting political story. And finally, Queens, New York, the most diverse county in the world, probably.
Yeah.
The 138 ethnic communities speaking 138 languages.
Wow.
Spoken by 97 ethnic communities.
Mm.
So that's that's what we wrote about.
Good. Very impressive. Now, while I think about it, I've got to get you to sign a permission form, which I'll have to...
Send it along. Not a problem.
Okay, I'll have to mail it to you, but I need your address.
Okay. It's 96. It's 96.
Yeah.
11 O'Clock Road. You spell out 11 O'Clock.
Okay.
11 O'Clock Road. The town is Weston. W-E-S-T-O-N.
Right.
Connecticut.
Right.
Zip code 06883.
06883. Okay.
Let me give you my email while we're at it.
Oh, good.
If you need to email on anything. Or I guess you already have it because
yes.
I did reply.
Yes.
So that's all stressful.
Yeah, but this form I'll have to mail to you.
Okay. Fine, no problem.
Yeah. So now the archivist asked me to ask you one question. What brought you to the University of Wisconsin-Madison? I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear it in your words.
Well, I was born there. My father went there. I had 8 members of my family altogether have gone to the university. And I wanted to take a year off before I started college, and I got a job as a copy boy at the State Journal.
Huh.
And while there, I discovered that I could get what was, in effect, a legislative scholarship, usually taken by football players, that would give me in-state tuition instead of out-of-state tuition. And the tuition then, as you probably remember, was $60 a semester. It went up to $75 in my senior year. So it was a bargain. I had lots of family friends. I lived with my aunt Elsie and my cousin Leah Heine in Madison, so I had a housing thing settled. It was very much because of roots.
Sure.
And the very first thing I ever published in a mainstream newspaper, if you can call Capital Times mainstream, was a column describing how I hitchhiked out to Madison that Aldrich Revell put in his column.
Oh, really? So where were you living before you, that made you a non-resident?
I went to high school in New York, and I went to school both in Connecticut and New York,
uh-huh.
but I did my high school in a school called Elizabeth Irwin High School in New York.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, yeah, that's interesting, all the large number of family members who've gone here. So then you enrolled here after your year downtown at the Cap Times, and...
No, State Journal.
State Journal. Okay.
Copy boy at the State Journal.
Yeah, okay, right. So what did you major in?
I majored in history, and I would have gone into liberal studies. The program didn't exist then.
Mm-hmm.
But I had history, but my student advisor was Paul McKendrick.
Oh, yes.
A classical professor.
Right.
And I was very much influenced by Merle Curdy, Bill Heseltine, at that time, and it's still true, Wisconsin had an outstanding history faculty.
Yes, it certainly did. I'm sorry to say it's probably not what it once was. There is a great deal of interest now in studying every culture and country in the world, and so the heavy focus on American history is no longer there. But
yeah.
But that's another story.
That's another story.
So... did you have any courses with Max Otto?
He had already retired.
He had retired.
I knew Max Otto.
Yeah.
I was present at his retirement ceremony at the Memorial Union, in which the last letter that was read was from my father, who was a student of Max Otto's in 1917.
My gosh. So then you immediately joined the Cardinal staff, I take it?
From the outset, I wanted to be editor of the Cardinal. I had as my tutor Bob Lewis, who had been editor in 1940-41,
mm-hmm.
and gave me some advice, and John McNelly, who was then working for the University News Service and was a wartime editor of the Cardinal. And I knew Dick Leonard, who was the ex-Cardinal editor, and so I got a lot of counseling on it. And I started as soon as possible to write a column.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a column for 4 years on the Cardinal.
It's interesting you mentioned John McNally because he's been a member of a book discussion group I'm in. And we're
Hello for me.
I'll do that. It's now 17 years, but John is beginning to fail. He must be 90, I think. And
I'm sure.
Nonetheless, he's been a great person to know and has told a lot of interesting stories about his journalistic experiences. So did
Bob
you...
Bob Lewis is alive and well in Madison.
Oh, really?
In his 90s, yes.
Wow. I didn't...
And Bob served and got every decoration but the Congressional Medal in World War II.
Really?
As the commanding officer of an all-black unit that went in the German campaign.
Really?
He's a very interesting guy, and I urge you to... He's Compass Menace, so he's worth talking to, and you might get some good interviews on him.
Okay, very good. That's a very good lead. So you now, when you became editor, were you paid in that job or not?
Yes, I got the munificent sum of $75 a month.
Yeah, I thought there was some payment involved, and I assume that probably Joe Dermer, when he edited The Octopus, was also paid.
Yes, I think The Octopus was paid, and the editor of The Badger was paid, but otherwise everything was free. I amend that. I think the business manager also got a monthly stipend.
Oh, yes.
I'm pretty sure he did.
Yeah.
A guy named Ed Pritchard was the business manager when I was editor. I became editor in the end of my sophomore year.
Yeah.
And was editor during my junior year.
That's right, yes, a very impressive. Fast man off the blocks. Well, so I remember Joe Dermer was one of the columnists in the...
I remember Joe very well.
Yeah, he died some years ago, and so no chance of getting anything from him. And then he became the editor of The Athenian.
That's correct.
And I think... I don't recall the details of that, but I think it was because he had some experience doing and editing a journal and actually getting the thing out. And so I think that inclined him toward taking a job and our selecting him for it. Do you know much about his background?
First question, were you active in the Athenian Society then?
Yes, I was. In fact, the society was reorganized or rejuvenated in November 1948. And I decided it sounded interesting, so I went and attended a couple of meetings. And then we had an election, and I ended up being elected treasurer. I think I was because I was the youngest interested person, they put the job on me. And there was Tom Devine from the law school was...
Yes, Tom Devine and Jim Haight.
And Jim Haight.
Guys I spoke with, yes.
Yes, that's right. So Tom was president, Jim I think was secretary, something like that. And we constituted the editorial board, or the publishing board rather. Anyway, because we had gotten this $5,000 legacy from a former football coach, John Richards, we decided we didn't want to do debating, but rather there was a need for a literary magazine. And so I was sort of led the way in trying to get approval, get the money transferred to us, going through the Student Life and Interest Committee and all of that, working with Mark Ingram, then the dean, Alden White, the secretary of the faculty, and Helen White, many other people. And so by May, Jim and I put together prospectus for the magazine and got approval from the Student Life and Interest Committee early in June, so we were set to go for the fall. In thinking back, in reading over my old letters, I found that one of the guys who gave us trouble was Gore Klopp. Remember?
Gordon Klopp. Who can I forget? Big brother. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And he, you know, was thought very highly of himself and wanted to be involved in everything, but we were able to get around him and get approval. So then over the summer, I went back to Racine, worked in a lumber yard there, and Jim was around, and George Bierce, I think, was going to be the editor, history, PhD. But over the summer, he did nothing. And so in the fall, we got together and picked Joe Dermer. And Joe moved quickly, of course. And since he was an English major, he had access to all of these literary people, people with literary aspirations, and so began assembling a set of manuscripts, short stories, poetry, etc., and got out the first issue in November of 1949. So in looking over the Scott Bates, a famous, well-known poet who went to Beloit College, was one of the
early... Yes, I knew Scott and his wife, yes.
Oh, you did? Interesting.
Sure.
And there were a few others. I haven't really tried to track down who they all were and what they accomplished. But it obviously gave young people a chance to show their literary skills. So the magazine came out in November, and we sold out the 1,000 copies right away and got a lot of good press from the State Journal, the Cap Times, Daily Cardinal. And I ground out lots of press releases. And at that time, it was easy to get them down to the State Journal and Cap Times because they were both down on the square rather than way out on Fish Hatchery Road where they are now. So the second issue came out in about February, I think. And I believe, although there are no records, we increased the press run to 2,000, which was overly optimistic, of course. And then probably the third issue, which came out in May, was probably down to about 1,500 issues. The financing of the whole thing is, there's not much in the way of records. I have a letter from Frank File. Did you know Frank?
No.
He was the business manager. He was got a BA in accounting in 1950 and worked with the magazine in 49-50 and also 50-51. And he got a law degree in 1952. Anyway, he was a guy, another guy from Racine that I hadn't known beforehand, but he did a very nice job. But the finances are all quite murky, and obviously there are no records to be found. But during the 1949 or 48-49 year, there were discussions about the focus of the Athenian. And there were two camps. Jim Haight and Tom Devine and others saw it to be more of a traditional literary magazine. Jim has mentioned the Partisan Review. I and another fellow from Racine thought it should be more like Harper's or Atlantic with, you know, a certain amount of nonfiction and less high literary in its content. And so... It, as it worked out with Joe Dermer, it became a literary magazine of high literary standard, you might say. And then, based on what Jim has told me, he and others were somewhat dissatisfied with the focus. And then somehow you came into the picture, and I don't know very much about that because I was finishing up papers and all before graduation. So can you tell me how you...
Yes,
were approached.
Sir.
What?
Yes, I'll be glad to tell
you. Yeah, okay.
Well, here's what happened. Jim Haight and I lived in the same building on Mendota Court, 25 Mendota Court.
Oh, yes.
It was right at the end of the keyhole.
Right.
Court. And he was on the upper floor and I was on the ground floor. And my roommate, in fact, was Jack Zeldis, who succeeded me as editor of the Cardinal.
Right.
And so Jim and I became friends, and through Jim I met Tom Devine.
Yeah.
And then they approached me and said, would I be interested in editing the magazine? And at that time, I was continuing writing a column for the Cardinal, and I also was the campus correspondent to the Milwaukee Journal.
Right.
So I had a fairly full docket.
Yeah.
But I was intrigued by the whole thing, and I had a particular reason why I was interested, in that my father had been the editor of the Wisconsin Literary Magazine in 1917-18, just leading up to World War I, and that his staff included Marjorie Kanan Rollins, Esther Forbes, a lot of famous writers.
Yes.
And My father, then alive and was then the telegraph editor of the New York Daily News, I thought, well, wasn't that nice that I could then continue in a family tradition?
Wonderful.
And I have to add that my grandfather was the editor of the leading German language newspaper in Milwaukee, Germania.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a third generation journalist and full of beans,
yeah,
full of self-confidence. And I was delighted with the opportunity to take the magazine. And I did want to put it in a both literary and political direction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I did is that I got my father to write a memoir about his time as the editor and looking back at his years, and other old-timers who had been associated with the literary magazine in years past.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a network of friends, and I grew on them. One was Basil Busacca, who was an English instructor for reviews. We wanted lively reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted some fiction, but a lot of provocative commentary as well.
Right.
And the great achievement of my editorship was the final issue, in which I did an essay called Generation of Jellyfish, which was a critique of my own generation, which had recently been baptized as the Silent Generation by Time magazine.
Yeah.
And I criticized the apathy, the political apathy of the students, their overriding concern with getting a good job as against a liberal education, etc. And it created quite a stir, and it led up to to my graduation. And that led in turn to a rather remarkable episode. I had friends on the Wisconsin Alumni Magazine. Clay Schoenfeld was the editor then, and I was interested in the Alumni Society, which was then run by a very, how can I put it, old-style, conservative, not very interesting guy. And all the seniors at that time were allowed to go to the Wisconsin Alumni magazine and vote as if they were members of the association. They were given a year's free membership.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack Seldes and I organized a rebel slate of candidates, including Wayne Morse, then the senator from Oregon, as rebel candidates against the official slate, which we said was to end this kind of communist-style thing where everything was fixed and advanced, et cetera, et cetera. And the then head of the WA was furious with what we had done, and at the meeting that I went to the day after graduation, the very first vote was to disenfranchise all the students who had come, to change the rules so the seniors could not vote. And we had a block of maybe 15 or 20 guys that we'd rounded up to come down to vote at the open meeting.
Uh-huh.
So that was my crowning episode of a troublemaker at the university. And it was written up in all the papers at the time. I have clips of it. If you want to have any of it, I can send it to you.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
But the resonance of the jellyfish thing was quite remarkable. And it got some national attention and so on. So those were things. But what I remember best about the Athenaeum was we had our offices on Park Street, right opposite a wonderful Italian coffee pizza place, which bought the back page ad of the magazine, as a matter of fact. And it was a guy named Earl Hansen, not Earl Hansen.
Earl Hagen.
Hagen,
yeah.
The business manager.
Right.
And our offices were shared with the then embryonic National Student Association.
That's right.
Which had just been formed at the University of Wisconsin and had its initial headquarters in this, I think it was a renovated public school. It was a low-cost building,
yeah,
with cheap rental, and that's where the magazine was. And that made a big difference financially. We did get Earl Hagen did get some good ads, business local ads, and so on. But I remember that the whole thing was a lot of fun. Ted Schwedenberg was one of the people that I recruited.
Right.
I don't know how much you know about Ted.
No, I don't know anything, and he's apparently not alive anymore.
No, he at last committed suicide. I'll tell you the story. Ted was partly descended from the famous Swedenborg in Denmark or Sweden, an 18th century theologian.
Yeah.
In fact, they had the Swedenborg branch of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also partly Jewish, that his mother was a Romanian Jewish opera singer. And he grew up in Germany. And he was very conflicted about his German childhood because he went into the Nazi youth things, and he said he was totally brainwashed by the Nazis. And he said it took him a long time to come to terms with all the horror of what was going on. And he decided he married a Jewish convert to the Baha'i religion, and they moved then to Baltimore, where he entered the medical school at Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
And he was studying mental disease, and he was particularly interested in the use of medicine, drugs, as a supplement to analysis and therapy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in a constant state of depression.
Hmm.
And he wrote, in fact, a very nice piece for the Athenaeum on Kafka that I remember.
Oh, yes.
But he was a haunted guy, very much a casualty of the horrors of the Second World War.
Hmm.
And then in a sort of depression, this must have been in the 1950s or early 60s, he killed himself. And it was a very upsetting thing to me because we had been quite close as friends.
Yeah.
And I liked him a lot, but that's what happened with Ted Schwedenberg.
Hmm. Did you know Bob Burkert, who became the editor after Ted?
No. The name, I may have met him, but I have no memory.
Yeah, he was a very accomplished artist, ended up at UW-Milwaukee. And his wife was also a very talented woman, child book illustrator, and, you know, one has won some of these Caldecott Awards and so on. But Bob took over, I think, at the year after Ted was the editor. Now, you asked about what happened after that. I went in the service in January 1951. I subscribed. The magazine came to my home, and they were piled up there. My mother kept everything. And so I really, really lost track of it all. Then in January 1954, I'd been in service, spent a year and a half over in Turkey helping to train Turkish troops, which was much better than going the other way.
Right.
But so I decided I would get a master's in international economics because I had traveled around the Middle East a lot, thought I might work for some oil company. So I came up to Madison and got an MA in June of 55. But in the spring of 1954, I recalled reading in the Daily Cardinal, and this was in a letter I wrote home to my folks, that there was going to be a meeting to talk about reviving the Wisconsin Idea magazine and to get it going again. But I decided I was too busy. I didn't want to get involved in that. And I didn't go to the meeting. And of course, nothing ever happened as far as I know. So the magazine had a life of 4 years. And then that was the end of it.
Right.
Since then, I'm not sure whether there has been much of anything until recently. There is something called, I think, Illustrations. It's a literary magazine, and I haven't really looked into it closely, but the copies are free. They're free in the library at the Union, and that makes a big difference, of course, if you've got somebody underwriting the cost of it, which was the problem with the Athenian. The $5,000 went fairly quickly, And right. I think the class of graduating class in maybe 1951 or 52 gave some money to the magazine to help it limp along, but it was not enough to keep it going.
I see. Okay, well, that rounds out. Is Tom Devine still alive?
Tom died several years ago. He was a lawyer up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I've not contacted his widow to find out if he has any records. I thought, well, unlikely. And so he's gone. George Bierce died a number of years ago. He taught, I think, at some place like Bates or college, small liberal arts college out in the East. Earl Hagen, I ran into in Chicago. I had a postdoc at the University of Chicago in 1961-62. And there I ran into Earl, who worked for the American Bar Association. And we got together a couple times for coffee during the year. And then Gwen Johnson, did you know her? A blonde, attractive blonde woman. And she and Earl eventually married, but then divorced. And I read years ago in the Alumni Magazine that she had passed along. John Richards, with his $5,000, helped to revive the literary magazine. And this compares with the literary magazine that your dad had edited that ran from the early 1900s until about 1929.
That's right.
And then after that, as far as I know, there was nothing. However, I've been urging the archives people here to try to find some student who would write a history of the literary magazines, which I think would be an interesting contribution to UW history.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was something in the 30s I have a dim memory, but I'd have to research that. But I'll also do is I'll go through some of my own papers, and if I have anything that's relevant to the opinion, I should add that what I was particularly proud of is we got John Wilsey, who is one of the
The artist.
Local artist.
Yeah.
He did a cover. It was a very sexy cover of me on the same issue that we did the Jellyfish editorial.
Yeah.
I thought graphically the magazine was very elegant and I'm very proud of my country. I have good relations with Joe Germer, and I kept seeing him for a period after graduation, and he was working for something called Save the Children, and I'd worked and helped him on a couple of things with that. So, and I remember Joe was a good columnist.
Yeah.
So I have very positive memories all around.
Yeah. Well, I do, too, and I was sad to, eventually read about its demise, but it gave a lot of people an opportunity to show their stuff. And as you say, the graphics, the magazine covers were great. And Bob Burkert, in fact, did a number of them in probably 1951, 52, 53. So anyway, you came in with a different conception of what the Athenian should be like, and apparently Jim and Tom liked that, and you were bringing to it what I had hoped it would have been, namely broader in its scope than simply a literary magazine.
Well, I think that yes, when we talked it over, I found that they were hospitable to the general approach that I said I would take if I were editor. So that was never an issue. And I don't recall ever hearing from either Jim or Tom, then or thereafter, that they didn't like what we were doing at the magazine.
You mean that first year?
That first year,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
I remember that we had some meetings during the time. But I think the meetings were more concerned with practical things and also generating ideas for articles
sure.
and things like that.
Yeah.
Jim was
was a great influence on me. I didn't know a lot about law or law school, and he was one of my tutors. And when I worked in Washington at the Washington Post, he was then at one of the leading law firms in Washington and helped explain to me some of the intricacies of how the legal system works in the Capitol. So a very fond memory of him.
Yeah. He, in an oral history interview with that I had with him, he told about his military experience. He ended up in a combat engineering outfit in France and Germany and putting up bridges over rivers, and had a very interesting military career. And then because they couldn't bring back everybody immediately, he enrolled in, they were encouraged to go to university there, and he went to some French university and learned French and got a head start or further start on his college degree. Yeah, a very interesting, wide-ranging guy. I liked him a lot. And I remember various times having dinner with him at his place. He would cook up some food, and or we would have meetings there dealing with the magazine and what to do with it.
Yeah.
Carl, I think that pretty well covers the ground. Very informative, and will really enrich the story of the magazine and your involvement in it. Anything else you'd like to
I should have mentioned that I had good relations with the economics department at the UW at that time. Salig Perlman, who's been a friend of my parents.
Oh, yes.
And also, see, my father has been a columnist for the Capital Times, so kind of a local figure. So that's how I had so many of these friends. But it was Harold Groves, I remember particularly.
Oh, yes.
And Professor Morton, who took on the intercollegiate boxing.
Right.
That was a good... The economics department was very lively then. Brandeis' daughter, Elizabeth Rauschenbusch.
Oh, yes, yes. And her son, Walter, who wrote a piece for the Athenian magazine. Yeah, and this is a Wisconsin idea, Debt, I think that was the title of it. What we need now are more Walter Mortons to help bring down college athletics. This is a very different topic, of course.
Well, this was a subject that Jack Zeldis, who's my successor, and I played a part in campus agitation.
Good.
Because we discovered that when Harry Spruwer stepped down as coach, recruiting a guy at Oklahoma, and he would have gotten a higher pay, significantly higher pay, than any of the professors at the University of Wisconsin. So Jack ran an editorial suggesting that he said something about the esteemed values of the university, and I backed it up in a column and created a statewide storm, and we were attacked by the sports editors of the Milwaukee Sentinel and the Milwaukee Journal. And we were told by the campus publishing company, our publisher, that we ought to tone down our talk about football because the campus publishers published the football program, and that they could lose that contract, which was indispensable to their economic health. And looking back at it, I think we were asking a lot of very relevant questions about the role of intercollegiate athletics.
You were. Carl, I hope that you're going to write an autobiography. You've got a lot of good stories to tell, and you tell them with a lot of enthusiasm and verve, and we need more of this sort of thing for younger people to find out how the world worked.
Okay, so listen, the next time I'm in Madison, my wife and I go out about once a year, let's have lunch.
Okay, let's do that. That would be wonderful. Carl, thank you again, and I will send you this form. I'll also send you some of my recent writing on the topic of diversity, a quite different kind of diversity you've written about. And as I mentioned in an email, I greatly enjoyed reading your wife's book and hearing her out here a couple of years ago when she came in and talked about it.
You were there.
Yeah. And then I've, of course, the exhibit, Mildred Fish Harnack, That was very interesting. And
they let me put her on so you can say hello to her.
Okay.
Oh, no, no, she's in the bathroom, so she can't make it.
Okay.
She can say that. That whole thing with Milsey's was a very powerful story.
Yeah.
And we still hope that it might be turned into a film at some point.
Yeah. Okay, Carl, thank you very, very much. And I'll get you, eventually you'll get a copy of the summary of the what's on your interview, and I'll send you a copy of the disc with the interview so you can have it for when you write your autobiography.
Okay.
Okay, it's okay. Wonderful talking, and thank you again.
Well, you're most welcome, and let's stay in touch.
Okay, very good.
Bye.
Bye.